So I want to call it best of the best. But do you, should we number them like best of the best part one and go to 10 because it's the 10 best episodes?
Yeah.
So this is a, essentially a time loop, but a different kind of time loop.
I see. We're doing the best episodes from every year.
Yeah. Episode 888, The Best of the Best, Part 1, The Lord of the Rings.
I love Lord of the Rings.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I am Ben DeVoto. We're back.
Ben, it's our 10-year anniversary, and part of the big celebration is that we're going back to each and every one of our past end-of-the-year listener appreciation jubilees. We're going to be in this feed for the year 2021. We're going to be putting out each of the 10 best episodes of the year that have happened over the last 10 years.
It's amazing.
Yeah, so... I was just going to list out here what were the contenders, and I'll tell you, well, of course, we're going to be doing Lord of the Rings, but here were the contenders for best episode of 2011, the first season. Episode 2, I Want to Believe, that's about aliens and theology. Episode 3, The Dark Knight on Trial, it's all about Batman. Episode 9, Attack of the Clones. Was that about? I mean, it must have just been about cloning.
I think so. Maybe I don't think it was about Attack of the Clones.
No, I don't really think so either. Episode 13, Dissecting Dr. Horrible. That's where we did a deep dive on Dr. Horrible. And
we probably praised Joss Whedon to the skies.
Yeah, probably maybe a little bit too much.
Whoops.
Do you think we'll get a sequel to Dr. Horrible now?
I think it's unlikely.
I think that time has passed. Let's see here. Episode 33, The Divine Time Machine. This is where we... just ask the question, would God ever allow us to send our consciousness back to the past to redo some bad part of our lives, our past? And
that seems like a very Matt Anderson
episode. Yes, it does, doesn't it? And the winner of best episode of the year from season 1, 2011, episode 23, Lord of the Rings. This one was where I came over to your house. I slept overnight for right. the one and only time on a Friday, Saturday morning. I believe it was July 2nd, 2011. Sounds right to me. We started early in the morning. We watched all three of the extended cuts back to back to back and then went straight to podcasting.
I don't think I have the stamina for
no,
that anymore.
No, we could never do it. I mean, I'm glad we did it then. But I want to ask you, I believe we did, you know, in our season one format, it's the only year we did this. We had news at the front and then did our main episode. Do you want this episode to just cut right to... the conversation about Lord of the Rings, or do you want to include the news from 10 years ago?
I feel like we should cut right to the main topic. Okay,
that's what I feel too. I should say, just for full disclosure, I have time looped this episode, so technically this is now the third time this episode has appeared in the main feed, but it's the best of the best. We have to make it happen, Captain.
Them's the rules.
All right, so...
Should we time loop the time loop?
Well, the time loop...
We could go from here to our introduction.
See, the time loop actually did have some added features. That's why I think the time loops are better than people think, because we have additional conversation. I sometimes add in feedback that... Let's say... So that was episode 23. Let's say in episode 27, we received feedback about episode 23. Well, now that feedback is a part of that time loop. So to answer your question, I don't think so. I think I'm going to go to the original.
I think that's the right call.
So, all right, Ben. Give us time travel music, and we'll be back with an outro.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I am Ben DeBono, and we are back.
We're back after a long day of movie marathoning.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't feel like we're back. It feels like we've been here
for 12 hours.
Well, and hours.
Yeah, because we have been live blogging, and you know, I've been talking as if we're podcasting.
Yeah.
We should have recorded that.
Oh, no.
No.
Okay, what part of going through 12 hours of footage sounds like a good idea to you?
Not video camera, like audio.
No.
Just straight to the web.
We're just going to like straight upload 12 hours of raw footage.
There it is.
Do you have any idea how many things we would have had to edit out of that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
All right. Well, everybody, hi. Today, we just watched all three Lord of the Rings trilogy movies back to back to back.
Yeah, so this is going to be a short show.
Well, hopefully, because what time is it right now?
I don't know. It's like...
It's only...
8 o'clock.
It's only 8, which doesn't sound late, but I stayed overnight at Ben's last night so that we could get...
In the guest room.
So we could, yes, thank you for clarifying. So we could get an early start. He woke me up at 7:30. We started at probably 7:45, so this has been...
7:41, according to our live blogging.
Wow. So go check out our live blog on thescifichristian.com.
Thescifichristian.com.
Any of our little comments back and forth. Are you loading it up right now, or do you want to save it for the actual show
content? I'm loading it up, but yeah, we're going to save it for the actual show
content. So today's theme, because we are so emerged within the Lord of the Rings world today, it's going to be all Lord of the Rings. We're going to talk about not just a trilogy. We're going to talk about Tolkien, his world, any books that might talk about it. So it's going to be completely spoilerish, so there you go.
Yeah, if you don't like spoilers and you haven't read Lord of the Rings, well, guess what? The book's been out for 70 years, so that's your own fault. Deal with it. All right, Matt, I think that's it for news.
I have some great questions for you about Lord of the Rings.
You're like falling asleep
in
front of me.
I'm rubbing my eyes. I'm just tired. But I've got some really good things about Lord of the Rings.
Should we read a few excerpts or start with a few and then we'll pepper them in along
the way? Why don't you pick your just two that stick out to you right now, and then I'm going to ask you my first Lord of the Rings question.
I'm going to start towards the beginning, so we'll work our way down throughout the episode. Right. I'm not going to read them all, but we'll choose some good ones.
Okay, good.
So at 8:12 a.m. Central Standard Time, Fellowship of the Ring, Disc 1, 29 minutes and 20 seconds into the movie, Bilbo had drops the ring on the ground right as he's about to leave Bag End, and Matt Anderson says, "Whoa, it didn't bounce." And I reply by saying, "Did you expect it to?"
Yeah, things bounce when you drop them. They don't just hit the ground and stick to the ground.
Rings bounce.
I don't know. You're going to bounce it on carpet.
I'm going to take off my wedding ring.
Okay.
And...
Oh, what was that?
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Okay. I will...
You've been proven wrong.
I will give you this point. All you right. have a valid point.
Thank
here.
You.
That totally bounced.
Yes.
I guess it's part of the magical properties of the One Ring that it has no bounce
all right.
to it. So I guess I stand corrected on that one.
There it is.
And then, here's a good one. Gandalf shows up at Orthanc, and he meets Saruman. And you say to me, "Is that Sauron?" And I say, "No, that's Saruman." And Matt says, "They shouldn't have made their names so similar. They should have called him Taruman."
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to have a movie with two villains that have almost the identical name, I think that's bad planning.
Okay.
Sauron,
but
Saruman.
Taruman is your best fix here?
I just picked the next letter in line, which would be T.
Oh, okay.
Taruman is what I came up with.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's
the
best solution.
They came up with tons of good names, but... He picked, or they could have just called the guy Eye Man.
Eye Man?
Yeah, Sauron is a big eye. He's kind of like a spirit eye. There it is. The spirit eye. The evil spirit eye. They probably have to add evil. Dark Lord spirit eye.
Wow. Okay. What's your first question? I don't think I have anything to say.
Well, I've got things specifically about the trilogy that we can bring up, but I was really interested that while we were watching it, just like when we did the Game of Thrones and you had read those movies and I got to ask you questions that go deeper into the story, you knew some stuff about behind the scenes for Lord of the Rings and even in the scenes.
Yeah.
And so, tell me some things about, what originally happened at the end. So you told me that something about the Shire was supposed to be burned.
Yeah, so in the books, this didn't happen in the movie, but in the books they get back to the Shire, and the Shire is not in good shape. It isn't burned, kind of like Sam sees in the vision, but it's kind of become a bit tyrannical. There's gates set up, and the hobbits aren't allowed back in, and they're treated with great suspicion, and on it goes. Mm-hmm. And eventually they realize that there's somebody who has taken charge named Sharky. And it turns
Sharky?
Out...
Sharky?
Yes.
You're kidding.
It is orcish for old man.
Okay.
So Sharky is in charge, and eventually it is revealed that Sharky is, in fact, Saruman.
Now, Saruman died falling off of a tower onto a wheel in the movie. Is that how he died in the book?
It is not. In the book, the scene kind of happens like in the movie, where Gandalf shows up and they talk to him at the tower. And then Gandalf basically leaves Treebeard in charge of Saruman and leaves him locked in the tower and saying, because he was so great and he was a good person for so long, we can't kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And Saruman eventually manages to convince Treebeard that he's harmless and he should be let out. And so he and Wormtongue go on their way.
No.
Yeah.
And that's, so where'd Wormtongue go then by the end of the book?
Well, Wormtongue is there with Saruman in the Shire controlling things. And eventually Wormtongue stabs Saruman in the back.
Just like we saw in the movie.
And then has killed himself.
Oh, so similar to the movie, but not exactly.
Yeah.
So why do you believe they took out the Hobbit Shire scene at the end?
Pacing.
Yeah.
It would have been kind of anticlimactic that, oh, we just had the huge scene at the ring, and now we're back at the Shire and everything's bad. But that's not how Tolkien thought about the story, actually.
How did he think about it?
Well, he didn't think about it as the ring being destroyed as being the climax, as about that this story was about the end of the Third Age and the effects of the ring disappearing and the tragedy that goes along with that.
Quickly talk about that Third Age thing you just said.
Yeah, so Lord of the Rings is set in the Third Age.
And this is something that Tolkien made up?
Yeah, he made
up different ages. Or so you thought until I corrected you.
Well, he invented his version of it, shall we say.
We've talked about this probably on the show, but in other religions and cultures, it's often said that we are currently living in the Sixth Age and that we're heading towards the Seventh.
Yeah, and Tolkien actually said the same thing about his ages, that we are in the Sixth currently and headed towards the Seventh.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you hear those police sirens?
I do. That's what we're living in the dangerous area of Ramsey, Minnesota.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I don't live here, but that's where we're currently
located. Pretty gangster
located.
Here.
Yeah.
I lost my train of thought. So we're in the Third Age, and the Third Age comes to...
You're talking about the movie. So back to the movie. The Third Age comes to an end with the...
Downfall of Sauron.
Yep, and the Fourth Age is beginning.
Yes. And with the downfall of Sauron, the Age of the Elves ends because their power is tied to the power of the One Ring. And so it's very much about the tragedy that comes that even though you save the world, there's really some negative consequences that go along with that.
Yes, because in the opening sequence of Fellowship of the Ring... Yeah. They showed how there's lots of rings made, but one ring to rule them all.
One ring.
And so once that ring was destroyed, all the power in all of the other rings went away.
Yes.
And the elves had rings?
They had three rings.
And what did those rings do? Is that what gave them immortality?
I don't think it's what gave them immortality, but it's what they used. They used the rings to build like Rivendell and Lothlorien, and they were kind of the source of magic that was holding all that stuff together.
So the elves, if I understand this correctly, at the end of Return of the King... All the elves left Middle-earth.
Yeah.
And because the age of the humans was at hand.
Yes.
Interesting. Poor elves.
Yeah.
Wait a second. And Arwen had given up her elfhood, correct?
Yes. So she stays behind.
So she is human now.
She's basically human.
What do you mean basically?
I don't know what her official status is, but she is mortal.
Is her ears... Are her ears still pointy?
They would still be pointy.
Okay.
Though, I mean, humans could have that. A little surgery.
Oh. That's interesting, but not back then, not Middle-earth.
Probably not.
And so you said that Tolkien wrote this as a mythology for England?
Yeah, it's meant to be like he was looking at, he loved mythology, and that's kind of one of the main things that he did, was study mythology along with Lewis. They were both really into it. And he looked at like, oh, we've got Greek mythology and Roman mythology and Norse mythology, but there was no mythology for England.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, by George, I'm going to write one.
Yes.
In that exact voice.
Uh-huh.
And write one he did. And so this is all meant to be like if England had a mythology in the way the Norse did with Odin and Loki and all those guys and our boy Thor, this would be like the British version.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So originally you had told me that Tolkien wanted this to be one long book?
Yeah. So because of paper shortages at the time in England, the publisher came to him and said, all right, lad, let's have a talk about this. We're going to split it into three parts.
We're going to split it into three parts.
We're going to split it into three parts.
Okay.
And he was not too pleased with that.
How angry was he?
Well, I've read his letters,
mm-hmm.
and he is always very courteous, kind of. And he, a lot of times, though, gets very annoyed in his letters with his publishers.
Wow. So what would the title have been of the one book?
The Lord of the Rings.
But once it got split up, he had different ideas for the titles for the three individual books, right?
Well, he was good with Fellowship of the Ring and Two Towers, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
I'd have to double check on that. But the one that was a little controversial was Return of the King.
Why? What did he want to call it?
He wanted to call it The War of the Ring.
Ooh, that's a cool title.
Yeah, really cool title and fits the book really well.
Yeah.
Because it's all about the defense of Gondor.
Return of the King is like the ultimate spoiler.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I mean, you don't see that until the very end, and it's in the title.
Yeah. But you got to think about the way Tolkien thought about stories, though. Tolkien didn't care about spoilers in the way that you and I would, especially you. Tolkien thought about story in terms of that I'm telling a mythology as though it would have been passed down from generation to generation. And in that mode of storytelling, it isn't about the spoiler. It isn't about the surprise. It's about the way you tell a story. It's about the characters in it. And so, like, if you think about a mythological history, when a mythology is told orally, in oral history form, everybody who's listening to that story knows how it's going to go. So they weren't looking for, oh, what's the big plot twist? They were looking for, what does this story say to us as a people? How does this tie into our heritage? What can we learn about ourselves through it? And Tolkien approached stories in very much the same way.
Yeah.
So the whole Lost approach to story, where it's all about spoilers and mystery,
yeah,
is extremely foreign in the history of storytelling throughout human history.
You're saying it's a modern phenomenon.
Very much so.
Interesting. So what else can you tell me about some behind the scenes stuff about Tolkien and writing the books, and what stuff would be interesting for our audience to know?
Well, it took him 13 years to write Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
He originally intended it to be a kind of a direct sequel to The Hobbit, and whereas right now it is a sequel, but it very much overshadows the original. He intended it to be shorter than The Hobbit.
Really?
That didn't go so well.
No, not at all.
Yeah. He had written the entire thing before any of it was published. So, again, because he envisioned it as one story. His son was stationed in Christopher Tolkien, who's done a lot of editing for him.
Oh, Furry Tolkien.
Wow. Yeah. If you're out there and you're listening to us and your name is, in fact, Christopher, I would like you to send a piece of hate mail addressed to Matt.
At thescifichristian.com.
Matt at thescifichristian.com. Actually, send it to feedback@thescifichristian.com because I would like to read it. So please, all of you out there, if you are named Chris, or you know someone who is, or you just want to pretend like you do because you want to write some hate mail, feedback@thescifichristian.com.
So get back to it. So JRR's son.
Yeah, he was stationed in, he was on, like, fighting in World War II or something at the time, as Tolkien was writing the Sam and Frodo chapters from The Two Towers.
Oh.
And so he would send his son those chapters. And so Christopher Tolkien was the first person to ever read what was going on. Oh. And he would send them to him as he would finish them.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So did he just write them out doubly? Because I don't think that... Did they do photocopying back then?
They did not.
No.
I don't know what he did. You know, Tolkien... I don't know. Like, part of what Christopher Tolkien has done is he's tried to reconstruct Tolkien's writing process, because he would write version after version after version, and then he would erase over them. And so Christopher Tolkien has even looked at, like, you can kind of see what word was erased here, and that was the original word in this part of the book, and he's trying to reconstruct how the manuscript grew. And
what is he doing that for? What's the benefit of doing that?
Scholarship.
Oh, scholarship.
I mean, Lord of the Rings is considered probably the most important book of the century, and certainly the most influential in terms of modern fiction and modern storytelling.
Why do you think that?
Well, it's been voted that way several times. It also,
why is it considered that, though? What aspects of the story?
I think it single-handedly launched a genre.
Oh, that's probably true.
Yeah, modern fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Before Lord of the Rings, fantasy was basically Conan the Barbarian and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so Tolkien completely changed the genre.
Yeah.
You know, even Game of Thrones and stuff like that, which tends to react against the Tolkien clones and is going for a very different tone than Middle Earth, would not exist if it wasn't for Lord of the Rings. And you pointed this out today as we were watching.
I noticed some strong similarities to Game of Thrones and to the Harry Potter series.
Yeah. What I would say Game of Thrones does is it takes some of the cliches, if you will, intentionally, and then twists them and throws them at you in a very different way.
Yeah.
Harry Potter, not so much.
They just rip it off?
Yeah. Giant spider. Ooh, we got one of those too.
That's funny. Yeah. Let's see. Oh, you had mentioned while we were watching the movies that he started writing a sequel to The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, called The Return of the Shadow.
And who is the shadow? Oh, Shadowfax, the horse.
No. Oh, we'll have to read about that one. Is now the right time for that?
Well, I mean, if you want.
Yeah, okay, let me find it. Here we go. Matt says, this is at 1:08 p.m. Central Standard Time, Two Towers, Disc 1 at 1 hour and 30 minutes. And you say, I love Gandalf and Aragorn. And I love Pegasus. You were feeling very affectionate.
At that moment. I think we were having pizza and I was really happy.
Yeah. And I said, do you know its real name? Referring to you calling Shadowfax Pegasus.
Uh-huh.
And you said, White Horse. And you were very definitive in the way that you said it.
Okay.
Nope. Oh, what is it? Shadow fax?
Oh,
like I'm faxing you a document.
Yep, that happened.
So I'm glad that you do now know Shadow fax's
so
name.
Return of the Shadow. Who is the Shadow?
Well, Shadow's like the dark power, the power of darkness, Sauron.
Oh, not Sauron.
It wouldn't be Sauron again.
He can't come back.
But it would be like people like Sauron.
But where are the people like Sauron
right
now?
I don't know, because the sequel never got written.
So tell me about... You know story details about the sequel that never existed.
Yeah, that there was basically like a cult forming in Gondor. And it was kind of about how the golden age of men that sort of began with Aragorn has ended.
Oh,
and
no.
Now things are starting to fall apart in the fourth age.
How distant future do you think it was?
I'm not sure.
Hundreds of years.
Yeah, I don't know. We could find out, but it's probably not worth it for right now.
Probably not right now.
So, interesting stuff.
Yeah. What about the...
Silmarillion. Yeah, you asked me about those at one point, and we didn't have it as an actual dialogue, so it's just too weird. But you were like, "Where are the Samarils?" And I had to explain to you. Well, first I had to figure out what you were talking about.
You knew what I was talking about. I said the Samarillion.
Where are the Samarillions?
And what? But the real word is
Silmarils.
Silmarils.
Yes.
Okay.
Those are like three jewels from Valinor. Yeah, which was the...
Valinor is heaven. Kind of. Elf heaven.
Yeah, or elf village, as you called it at one point today.
Okay. So, the jewels inside heaven, and what's the point of the story?
Well, they like have... there's this whole long history of them, and I'm going to get it wrong if I say it, so then somebody will write in and correct me. But basically, there was like these two trees that provided all the light, and it was super glorious.
Tree
and beautiful.
Beard?
No. No.
Ents, you mean?
No. I mean trees.
Like the walking trees.
Not walking trees. Just trees.
They're called ants, Ben. I learned that today. Because at first I thought they said ants.
Okay, do you understand that there's a difference between ants and trees?
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you right now. There's a difference. I hope that you realize that, because trees can't talk. That's just silly.
Who said anything about them talking? Oh my gosh, this is getting weird. Okay. Well, that's all from here.
Okay, so the Silmarillions were
the Silmarils.
But covered by trees.
They were not covered by trees. They were part of the trees, and they were giving light to everything. And then Morgoth, who was the Dark Lord before Sauron, stole them.
Oh, so this is a prequel.
With Anguliant, who is Shelob's mother.
Who's Shelob?
The spider.
Oh, my gosh. So Morgan, who...
Morgoth?
Morgoth, who is Sauron's predecessor, teamed up with the mother spider.
Yeah.
And together, they were trying to steal these jewels.
They stole them, actually.
And so, does this take place before Hobbit, even?
Yes, long before Hobbit. So, this is about the first and second ages. And so, most of the Silmarillion is about the history of the war between the elves and Morgoth, and how, you know, they'll kind of not be at war for a long time, and then they'll be at war. And Elrond and Galadriel are in it because they're immortal.
Oh my gosh, they live so long.
Yeah. And so, and then it's about the race of Numenor, which... It's kind of the men before Gondor.
Numenor?
Numenor.
Is that the line that Aragorn is from?
Mm-hmm.
I got that.
Yeah, well done.
Thank you.
And how Numenor used to be this great and glorious kingdom, and then Sauron came in disguise as kind of an angel of light.
So the Silmarils is about the Sauron's rise to power?
A little bit. It's mostly about Morgoth.
Does it have the battle where his finger gets chopped off?
It does.
Oh my gosh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah. So it's kind of written as a history. Mm-hmm. It's not like reading a novel. It's like reading a history book.
That's really interesting.
Or a mythology book.
And that was by Tolkien, correct?
Yeah. He never finished it, but Christopher Tolkien edited his notes together after his death. And so it was published in the 1970s.
Very interesting. What about Children of...
Húrin, which is part of the Silmarillion. It's an expansion Tolkien intended to do with the Silmarillion. Mm-hmm. And
it takes place during the same time period then?
Yep.
Also
so
history?
Morgoth is a villain in that, and the Silmarils make an appearance. So basically, to kind of close off the story of the Silmarils, Morgoth had them for a long time, and there's a big battle about them, and I'm not sure what happened to them eventually, but eventually they were rescued and, I think, brought to Valinor or something like that. And so all this stuff happened, and Morgoth was eventually defeated, and on it goes, and then Sauron came to power in his wake and forged the rings, and that began the third age. Actually, the defeat of Sauron the first time was the end of the second age, and then the third age began, and then is ended with the final defeat of Sauron with the destruction of the ring.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. Any other books that are in this world that I missed?
Nope. I mean, Christopher Tolkien has a 12-volume history of Middle-earth, which has some additional stories in it.
That he wrote?
No, this is his editing together his father's work.
Mm-hmm.
So he starts with the very earliest manuscript stuff that Tolkien wrote in the trenches in World War One.
Oh my gosh.
Like his earliest attempts at writing any type of story.
That's awesome.
So it's tough to tell how much of it's canon because of that.
Yeah.
But again, I don't think Tolkien would have thought of things that way. I think he would have thought of it as a mythology where inconsistencies don't matter as much,
mm-hmm.
because it's about a collection of stories, not about one storyline where everything has to fit together perfectly.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
So yeah, you get some of his very earliest writing. He began by developing languages, mm-hmm. and so he was writing languages as like an 18-year-old guy.
And didn't he write the languages before he wrote the story?
He did.
So he based the story around this language he made up.
Which is a pretty cool way of building a fantasy world.
It's kind of weird, if you ask me. I mean, it obviously worked out well.
Yeah.
But
I don't know anyone else could ever do it.
Yeah. I mean, why even waste your time, you know, writing a whole language? Because the language isn't going to reveal to you a story, but maybe it did.
Well, Tolkien was a linguist. Mm. That was like of dead languages. So he was, this is what he did professionally, was he taught about languages.
Is it possible he didn't invent Elvish, but he actually just brought it back from the dead?
Oh, like it's secretly out there?
Yeah.
Maybe all of Lord of the Rings is just an uncovered document that he found in his research.
And he's making tons of money off of it.
Yeah, well, not anymore.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, Peter Jackson, though.
His house.
Yeah, his estate.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah.
Furry Tolkien.
Furry.
Making out like a bandit.
All right, Ben, let me change the subject here. I noticed something as I was watching it that came up right away in the first movies, and I felt like it really continued throughout. We didn't really see a resolution to
like
this.
Like Hobbits?
Here we go. I'm about to get to it.
Okay.
We didn't really see a resolution to this theme until the end, but humans were kind of looked down upon by everyone in Middle Earth.
Yeah.
They talked about how men are easily seduced by power, so the ring wanted to get to men because they knew that that would ultimately lead to Sauron. They also said that humans could have thrown the ring into Mount Doom a long time ago, but this guy was selfish and evil, was allowed to endure. So to me, it just kind of felt like, well, typical. Humanity always screws up, and here's another example right here in The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, so do you think that they are justified in their opinion of the humans? I mean, it's kind of harsh, like you said.
Well, we're talking about, from a Christian worldview, we're fallen. And so if we haven't been restored by Jesus, our natural inclination is bad.
Yeah, I think that the elves' perspective wouldn't be the fall, and that, you know, men are fallen, because elves can mess up too.
Mm-hmm.
And they can kind of do bad things too. But their point with being critical of men is that because men's lifetimes are so short, they don't have kind of the long-term perspective and wisdom of the elves,
mm-hmm.
and so they tend to be reckless or hasty, as Treebeard would say, and they do dumb things.
They were slow.
Boom, ba-room. Don't be hasty.
Boom, ba-room?
That's what he says. It goes, boom, ba-room.
What does that mean?
That's like Treebeard's tree rumble. That's how Tolkien writes it in the book. Boom, ba-room.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yes. Anything else you want to say about that? I thought that was interesting.
No, but it's definitely a big theme in there, and that's kind of what Tolkien was getting at, that these great and glorious creatures have passed away from Middle-earth, and the elves are no more, and they were like the higher race,
mm-hmm.
and now it's just less to us who kind of screw things up.
Typically, like, we just always come back around and mess it up. So we heard that the end of the Second Age into the Third Age was Sauron's first fall. Same thing with the end of the Third into the Fourth.
But that time, his fall was permanent,
because
the ring was destroyed.
But I don't think it would be too far off to think that at some point there'll be a new evil that rises up. Man will probably screw up again, and then we'll see fourth going into the fifth.
And that was kind of Tolkien's point.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really interesting because Lord of the Rings is not meant to, from Tolkien's perspective, wasn't necessarily meant to be an uplifting, yeah, we got him story. It was meant to be a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And we touched on this a little bit, but maybe we should expand on that theme a little more.
Okay.
Did you pick up on that at all as we were watching?
Well, definitely in the sense of Frodo specifically, his character. Here's some things that I was sort of upset about, and then I'll go into directly answering your question.
Upset? Oh, no.
Yeah, I was upset about something. And I had seen Return of the King back in the theater in 2003, and I'd never seen it again since then. So in some ways, some of it, totally fresh to me. And especially with the expanded edition.
Yeah.
There's tons of things I'd never seen. So one thing I made a note about is that the end kind of sucked for Frodo. Not the very end. I'm talking about the point in Mount Doom when he finally makes it. His quest is complete. He's standing.
I did it!
Well, he didn't say that at all. He's standing over the lava pit, He's able to drop it into the fire. It's basically a lava pit. Why are you making a face?
Well, I don't know if that's how I'd describe it, but okay.
What would you describe it as? It's a volcano-looking thing with lava flowing around.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, so he's standing over there. Sam's like, throw it in, Frodo. Sam's doing the right thing. Frodo's hesitating, and as a viewer, you're like, just do it. And then he turns bad. Evil smile. It's mine.
Yeah.
And then, let me continue the story. Gollum shows up, knocks Sam out. Gollum fights Frodo, bites his finger off, and now Gollum has the ring. And Frodo, still out of his mind, is fighting Gollum. And he never actually himself takes the step to get rid of the ring as a hero. He just in a fight, him and Gollum both go over. Frodo catches onto the cliff. Gollum falls into the lava with the ring. So in essence, this is supposed to be a heroic journey, and Frodo never makes the heroic choice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's messed up.
It is. And that's very intentional on Tolkien's part to have it that way.
So I want you to talk about it, but let me go on to the very end.
The
very end, we find out that Frodo is now going to leave with the elves. He's going to go to Elf Heaven. Or
Elf Village, as you call it.
Yeah, leave on the ship with Gandalf, Bilbo, and the rest of the elves. And he tells Sam, we wanted to save the Shire. The Shire is saved, but not for me. So he was permanently damaged mentally by what happened with the ring.
Oh, big time.
Big time. You could just tell he just wasn't himself anymore. He couldn't. I mean, we saw some scenes with him and the all four of the hobbits at the bar, kind of.
Yeah.
They were smiling and having a good time, but.
Oh, they were probably drunk.
Yeah, but it wasn't quite right still. And so Frodo realizes my life here is never going to be okay. And so he leaves.
Yeah.
So talk first about the non-heroic end of the ring quest, and then talk about the very end.
Well, and we should probably make clear that when Frodo sails off to, Valinor, it's really a metaphor for his death. You know, he's going to his death. I think you said that's kind of heaven.
Yeah.
So just to be clear, it's not that he goes on vacation somewhere. It's a metaphor for death.
So they talked about having a new adventure. I mean, is it going to be a heaven where there's new things to do, or is it like a heaven where you just stop existing?
No, it's like new things to do.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, do you remember the scene where Gandalf's describing to Pippin that, death is not the end and there's white shores and...
Oh, I wrote it right here.
Yeah.
Death is just another path. One that we must all take. And then he talked about a great curtain.
Yeah, the curtain's pulled back, and then you see white shores, and he describes
something
it a little
like
bit.
Silver or something?
Yeah. That dialogue, this is kind of cool, actually.
Okay.
That dialogue is not said by Gandalf in the book.
Oh, who is it?
That is a description Tolkien gives for what Frodo sees as he completes his journey at the end after he sails away. That the curtain is rolled back and he sees these white shores and this glorious land that he's going to live in.
Uh-huh.
So it's actually kind of cool the way they did that in the movie, that they took this description of Frodo finally seeing his final resting place, and they put it in Gandalf's mouth describing to Pippin how death isn't the end.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So tell me about the ring getting thrown in almost on accident.
Yeah, so I would say that, and I think what you're saying when you say you didn't like it isn't that it was a bad plot choice so much as like it's a that kind of sucks for Frodo type
unsatisfying
thing.
For we wanted him to be the hero, and in the end he really he carried the burden, which was heroic.
Definitely he's a heroic character, when it comes down to it,
that last moment he did not make the right choice, and he never did. It was an accident.
So we're sci-fi Christians, and we're all about extracting the deeper themes from story. What do you think Tolkien's trying to say there?
I think he was saying that the ring had corrupted him, just like it had corrupted Gollum, and we see him eventually go off to what's it called,
I think it's Valinor.
Valinor.
I hope I'm not saying that wrong. We're probably going to get 100 emails.
Yeah.
You said it wrong.
So we see him go off, and I think that he realized I'm corrupted. And like I said before, this world is never going to be okay for me.
I'm going to look it up.
Okay.
Frodo sails to. Yes, Valinor.
Okay.
Got it correct. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that Tolkien does present it as though Frodo has been corrupted by the ring. But let me ask you this. Could anyone have gotten there and actually thrown it in, having carried the ring that far?
It didn't appear that anyone could have.
And I don't know if you caught this or not, but Tolkien's trying to set up that the closer he gets to Mount Doom, the harder and harder it is to resist the ring's temptation to give in.
Well, and even... in the way he said it was heavy on him.
Yeah.
It got harder and harder for him to actually get to Mount Doom.
Yeah. For example, even Sam, when he has the ring briefly, after Frodo is almost killed by Shelob and Sam takes the ring. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the book, Sam is tempted to give in to the ring's power at that point, and it's a very real temptation for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he
We did see that in the movie a little bit when Frodo asked for it back, and Sam hesitated just a little.
Yeah. So even Sam isn't incorruptible under the ring's influence.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting.
Let's talk about Sam.
Yeah.
Now, you were mad at me at the beginning because I thought he was doing a few weird things. I can't remember what I was getting on this case about. I think some of his lines are just some of the choices he made.
You were kind of mean to both Sam and Frodo throughout the entire movie.
Well, Frodo, let's just talk about Sam. So, okay. But by the end, Sam is the best character.
Definitely.
Gandalf, though, I like Aragorn. But Sam, the heroic journey would have never happened unless he had had Sam there. And so when I was talking with Ben about our episode about sidekicks a couple weeks back.
Yeah.
If we were to do this over, I would have to put Sam as my number one sidekick. There's no, he was there for Frodo every step of the way. There's no other sidekick I can think of that the hero needed so much. Because let's take Batman and Robin, for example.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Robin is useful to Batman, but Batman could do it alone. Frodo needs Sam. Sam has to be there. Frodo could not do it by himself.
Yeah.
In fact, and it's most clear when Sam puts him on his back and literally carries him up the mountain.
Oh, that's such a cool scene.
Oh,
can't carry it for you, but I can carry you.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
So I want to ask you, Ben, then, who do you think is the more messianic character, Sam or Frodo?
It's tough to say. I mean, they both kind of bring out different parts of the messianic archetype. Where Sam, or Frodo's the one who takes the weight of the world's guilt and mm-hmm. sin and evil upon himself. So there's that. But ultimately, like you said, he's not the hero. And if it wasn't for Sam, he wouldn't have kept going. He would have given in. So Sam is kind of more the heart and the strength of the messianic character. But Frodo definitely personifies the part of the Messiah that takes evil upon himself.
Yeah.
So it's really tough to say who's more. I think that they really complete each other in that way.
Oh, my gosh. You took the words right out of my mouth. I was just thinking about, Frodo sacrificed, and we know that Jesus sacrificed.
Definitely.
So to me, that's a main aspect of messianicness. But Sam and Frodo together, they became almost one person by the end.
Totally.
They both had their different messianic qualities, and they had to work together.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if you can even view them as... they were two separate people, and Frodo had the greater burden, I think.
Definitely.
But I don't know if neither of them could have done it alone. I think Sam probably would have given in. If he had had the ring originally, I think he would have given in faster than Frodo did.
Yeah, for sure.
I think Frodo seemed more strong-willed, but Sam was, I don't know, he was just, like you said, the heart. He was the most supportive person you could possibly ask for.
They each had their role they had to play.
Yeah. And to think, he's just a gardener.
This is true.
Do you think they were that good of friends before this?
Yeah, they were good friends.
Okay.
So I want to get back to the question about what's Tolkien trying to say with Frodo gets to the end of his journey, he's not able to throw the ring in. Because
mm-hmm.
I think he's trying to say that no one could have done it.
No. So no one could bring the ring all the way to Mount Doom and be able to do it.
Here's the tension I think that Tolkien's trying to throw at us. Because it's kind of a depressing message, because what he's basically saying is that all of us are powerless before evil,
mm-hmm.
ultimately. However, Gandalf has this speech about how Sméagol still has a part to play, and there's other powers at work, and he really implies that fate has stepped in and preserved Sméagol so that he would be able to do something at the end, which we later find out is he's the one who, you know...
Essentially put it in.
Exactly, yeah. Unintentionally.
Yeah.
But if it wasn't for Sméagol, the ring never goes in. So I think what Tolkien's trying to say is that we are all powerless before evil ultimately, but there is hope because there's a higher power, God. It's not God in the way we think of him in terms of Middle Earth, but mm-hmm. certainly representative of God, who intervenes on our behalf and predestines us to be able to overcome evil, if you will.
Ben, was there any sort of God character in Lord of the Rings?
In the Silmarillion, there certainly are.
Oh, tell me about that.
Well, there's one kind of main dude named Ilúvatar who kind of creates the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then He gives he creates several lesser beings called the Valar, who are basically make up the pantheon of Tolkien's mythology.
Oh, okay.
So similar to like a Roman or Norse pantheon, mm-hmm. but the difference is that there is kind of one main god who's very, very similar to God the Father and creates in the same way.
Oh, okay. So in this world, there was some sort of god being. Did they make any mention to it? I thought there was just one offhanded remark about some sort of god. Did you catch on it?
There might be.
I'm looking through my notes here to see if I can find it, and I don't know if I wrote it down.
Manwë is kind of the main god. Okay. And he's the one who's in charge of the eagles. So whenever you see the eagles present in the stories, it's a sign of divine intervention.
Oh, it is.
And that's why they don't appear very much, because the eagles aren't just like another team who show up whenever. They are under Manwë's control, and he only sends them in extreme circumstances.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder why they didn't touch on that in the movie.
It's not really touched on in the book. You have to read both Tolkien's notes and the Silmarillion to understand it.
Okay.
Because people would ask him about the eagles. They'd be like, why didn't the eagles just show up all the time? And he was like, well, it's because of this. And then he explained it.
Okay. Hey, I wanted to ask you another question about Sam that I have here, following along with the Messiah question.
Go for it.
So there's a scene where Sam wakes up and hears Gollum talking to himself. Gollum and Sméagol are arguing back and forth.
Yeah.
And they both now come to an agreement, this split personality, that they will kill the hobbits.
Yeah.
Sam hears this. He freaks out. Frodo wakes up. What are you doing to Gollum? And he's like, I heard him say he wants to kill us. And Sméagol's like, no, I want to do it. So Frodo takes Sméagol's side, which is really weird because Sam's been there for him all along.
Yeah.
Now, Sam just goes along with it. They go on their journey. They continue on, even though Sam knows that Gollum wants to kill them. I guess I'm interchanging Gollum and Sméagol, but they're obviously the same person.
They are the same.
Ben, what was Sam thinking here? I have a bigger question to ask, but it feels like he knows Gollum wants to do bad to them. He knows that he wants to kill him. Now, here's the big question. Was Sam morally right to not kill Gollum? In the sense, just go back to our Batman episode. Is he morally justified in what he does? Should Sam have actually got rid of Gollum, knowing that all along Gollum was trying to murder them?
Well, it would have been the doom of Middle-earth if he had.
Well, we know that now, but I'm saying from the perspective of Sam's there to watch Frodo's back.
Yeah.
He's letting – I mean, there's one scene where Gollum's like, we'll take these stairs and we'll go to something death. What was it? Tower of Death or something?
Minas Morgul.
Yeah. And so – and then I said to you at that point, at this point, if I was Sam, I would just put my foot down. Do you have this quote?
Yeah, you talk for a second and I'll find it.
Yeah, because I just don't – I mean, sure, it's one thing that you have to go along with what Frodo says. But at some point you have to say, look it, he wants to murder us.
So here's what you said. You said, if I was Sam, I would really put my foot down. It's like, okay, I heard him say he wants to kill us, and now he's leading us to a place called the Dead City. And I responded with, that's a fair point.
Yeah, and so right away I'm thinking – all right, Frodo might be mad for a second, but you should probably just throw Gollum off this cliff. Because, and then, speaking of cliffs, like, that night, they...
Oh, this is pretty hysterical.
The sleeping positions were, I mean, not like, positions, right, but the location choice. Yeah. Sam was literally sleeping on the edge of a cliff. Frodo was a little bit closer off of the edge of the cliff. And Gollum was up above them in perfect killing range.
Yeah, it was not the best place to sleep, I don't think.
So, even though I like Sam... this was not a smart choice.
Well, let me see if I can explain it. Maybe not justify it entirely, but let me...
So was he morally justified?
Well, I think to answer that question, you have to first answer what was Frodo thinking.
I think Frodo was out of his mind.
I disagree.
You think he was in his right mind?
Here's why I think that he was so intent on preserving Gollum, because of what Gandalf had said to him.
Okay.
These were like Gandalf's last words to him, just about.
Okay.
And he said, I believe that Gollum still has a part to play in all of this. And so I think Frodo is hanging on to that and saying, I'm going to believe what Gandalf said, and I will not get rid of Sméagol. I will have him with me because I agree with Gandalf and I'm trusting him that Sméagol does have a part to play.
Hmm.
And so I think that you could justify Sam by saying that he is willing to listen to Frodo even though he disagrees with him. Mm-hmm. He defers to his decision, which is ultimately the right one, because Frodo in turn defers to Gandalf and recognizes somebody who has more wisdom than he does.
You know, also, Frodo did have a little bit of trust issues because everybody was trying to steal the ring.
Yeah.
And so I could see him suspecting Sam as a culprit.
Okay, but let's talk about this for a second. This was an addition to the movie. The whole, go home, Sam!
Oh, yeah. So that was not in the book.
No, and they really played up the whole Frodo being mad at Sam and Sam being mad at Smeagol. Mm-hmm. In the books, Sam certainly is suspicious of Smeagol and Gollum, and he doesn't like him. Mm-hmm. But there's none of this huge tension where Sam and Frodo are fighting about whether or not to keep or Gollum or send him home.
Yeah.
And all added.
Okay, that's interesting. It seemed, because it felt repetitive. Like, yeah. Every 2 minutes, Sam's mad at Gollum.
Oh, what are you doing again?
You stole the bread.
You stole the bread.
I.
So here's my favorite part of this. My favorite part of this is that first Frodo sends Sam home, which is stupid. And again, it's not in the books, and it's a really stupid thing because they made it to Mordor. Well, Sam, great job, mate. How about you pack it up and just go home?
Well, he believed Gollum about the bread. He's like, no, you can't come with me anymore.
Yeah. And then Sam hikes all the way down the mountain that they just spent hours upon hours climbing. He finds the bread, and it's like, yeah, I guess I'm not going home after all. He turns around and climbs back up the mountain.
And the thing is, it's not like the bread revealed, oh, Gollum did it after all, because he knew Gollum did it. I didn't do it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, then he turns around, goes back up, saves the day.
And plus, another dumb addition, if you're going to add the scene, at least make it make sense, that Sam gets down, finds the bread, and it's like, you'd think he'd be like, oh, we can survive. We have the bread we need.
Or maybe he'd take a bite because he hadn't eaten in hours.
And what does he do? He grabs it in his fist, crumbles it up.
In anger.
Throws it away, and then proceeds to climb back up the mountain. It's like, dude, you have no food. You do not do this.
Hey, I think I just started looking at my notes and I found this thing, and this might be some reference to a higher power.
Go for it.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
There are other forces at work in this world besides the will of evil. Bilbo was meant to find the ring, in which case you were also meant to have it. So he's talking to Frodo here.
Yeah.
And that is an encouraging thought.
Yeah, it's definitely a reference to higher power. And that's the speech that I'm saying that Frodo is remembering when he keeps Smeagol alive.
Okay.
Because that's also where, if you remember that scene, it starts by Frodo saying to Gandalf, pity that Bilbo didn't kill him when he had the chance. Mm-hmm. And Gandalf says, well, pity is what stayed Bilbo's hand. Don't be so quick to deal out death and judgment. Smeagol may still have a part to play. And I think that Frodo remembers that, and it really sticks in his head.
It must have, because it didn't really stick in my head.
Yeah.
It seemed like just a remark, an offhanded remark at that.
Oh, yeah.
But it ends up being the one thing that Frodo hangs on to, if your theory is correct.
So, yeah, and I agree with you that Frodo's kind of going crazy, but that's not him going crazy at that point. That's him listening to Gandalf.
Interesting. So I wanted to ask you, Ben.
Go for it.
You had, in particular, liked a specific line, and I wanted to ask you what it was that you liked about it. So I'm going to go ahead and read this line. It was a line spoken by the Ents, who are not trees. These are the talking and walking trees. They are the Ents. So here is the line that I wanted you to react to. I think it's Gandalf that says this. The Ents are going to wake up and find that they are strong.
Yeah, I love this line.
What was it that specifically that you really love about it?
Okay, so the Ents are super, super powerful, as I think you saw when they finally go to war, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they basically, all of them were great fighters except for that one that got set on fire.
That was kind of hysterical. Yeah. It was like, put me out, bro! Where's that water?
Yeah, that's where I said something on the, you don't have to look it up.
I don't think I have that one.
I'll just recreate it. So, it was at that point that Saruman's army found out the trees on the Ents' secret, the secret weakness.
That's pretty hysterical.
Yeah, because that will do it. They're made of wood.
Yes, and that would be a good idea. Yeah. I think I might have it here, actually.
I probably just said it, though. I don't think we could really.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That's basically what you just okay, said. So the Ents are going to wake up and find that they are strong.
Yeah, so the Ents are these super powerful creatures, and they're basically doing nothing. And there's this whole war going on around them, and the world's falling apart, and they're doing nothing. And they're not using their strength for good. Mm-hmm. And this is representative of a great many people.
Really?
In the world.
Like who?
Like people who...
Oh, you're talking about humans.
Humans.
Yes. Current living humans.
Us.
Who
are called by God to do good things, but because of our passivity, we choose not to, mm-hmm. and we choose to basically just sleepwalk our way through life resigned and not doing anything worthwhile.
Yeah, and you can really see that in the trees because they were saying, well, we're not even involved in this war. So it's not our world, I think they even said.
Yeah.
And then Pippin and Merry pointed out, this is your world, and once the first battle is done, they're going to come here.
Exactly. And so I think that I just love the symbolism in, when you look at it that way, of Gandalf saying they're going to wake up and find that they are strong. And like, how many people is that true of, who their lives look like just a complete disaster, but if they would just move beyond their resignation and passivity and deal with some of their issues, could really do great things for God and for the kingdom. Yeah. And instead they just sleepwalk their way through life.
Yeah. Another theme that was very super strong.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Hope. Non-stop. Every character talked about hope, except for the villains.
Yeah, and I think there's a really... The series takes a really interesting perspective on this, but I want to hear what you have to say first before I...
What do I have to say on hope?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there were some scenes where they were saying, you know, we still can hold out hope, and then there was other scenes. One that specifically sticks out to me is where Gandalf was talking to Pippin about hope, and I think Pippin might have said that, you know, do we have any hope that Frodo's going to be able to do this?
Yeah.
Now? I think now that all this is happening, and Gandalf says... There wasn't much hope to start with.
That's true.
Yeah, and so I think that there is a semi-realistic view of hope in here, is that it's good to be optimistic, but we're also realistic.
This is another part of the tragedy in Lord of the Rings. One of the things that really doesn't come across very well in the movie, I don't think anyway, and maybe not even in the book unless you're looking for it and you're understanding this is what Tolkien's getting at, is that when they send the Fellowship off and when they send Frodo off, they're not expecting him to succeed.
Mm.
They are expecting him to fail. And they're looking at this and saying, we have to try something, but odds are against this working.
Especially since they picked the smallest, the weakest of all the species.
Right. Yeah, so they're looking at... and
actually, the dwarves might be smaller, but definitely not weaker.
No, they're not smaller. Dwarves are a little bit bigger.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, little factoid for you.
Thank you.
But in the book, they have the Council of Elrond's a really long scene. And they debate all their different options, and they decide this is the best one, has any chance of succeeding, but in all likelihood, it won't.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably going to fail. And so one of the themes that comes out in the story that Tolkien's trying to draw on is, what do people do when there is little or no hope, and how do they react in that situation?
Mm-hmm.
And you see like Frodo and Sam, who just keep going and will go until we literally fall over and can't walk one more step, even though we don't have much hope.
You see Pippin and Merry, who just... take on the pleasure of this world and almost try to not think about what's actually happening.
Yeah. You see, well, at certain points.
At certain points in the movie. Maybe not consistently. But yeah, I mean, think about what's the first thing they did after the tree battle. They went and found pipe weed and food.
Yeah, well, they were celebrating. They just won a big victory, man.
And let's see, let me try to think of another thing. When they first were on their journey, just the Four Hobbits, before they got to Elfland.
Rivendell.
Rivendell. They went right to the tavern and just went crazy.
Yeah, but I think that that's more Hobbit naivety than it is that they're just trying to enjoy the pleasures of life, and that's how they're responding to a lack of hope.
Yeah, maybe in that early scene, Brett really doesn't apply at all.
Yeah.
Because they don't really know how bad it is yet.
But one negative example would be Walter, also known as Denethor.
Oh my gosh, he was so awesome. Yeah. Walter Bishop from Fringe was in this movie, and I didn't know until just a few days ago he was even in the second and third sequel.
Yeah.
He was awesome.
And if you're wondering where he is in the second, it's probably because you've never seen the extended edition.
Oh, really?
There's a long scene in there with Sean Bean and John Noble in the Two Towers extended edition that did not make the theatrical cut.
Oh, yes.
It was a really great scene.
It was awesome.
Yeah. So a little Game of Thrones Fringe crossover.
Good. So you were talking about hope with Walter.
Well, he gives up. And he's already given up by the time Gandalf shows up. He's like, he's not rallying the defenses. He's looking at this huge host marching against him and saying, there's no hope, so I'm giving up.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a character who's constantly torn throughout the series is Théoden, who we see him at Helm's Deep. And at first, he kind of gives up. And then Aragorn rallies him and says, let's ride against them. Even though we're going to die, let's take them down with us, as many of them as we can. And then Gandalf shows up and saves the day. So that worked out well. But then later on,
which was an awesome scene when he came
in. Totally love that scene. But then later on, after Aragorn leaves the camp in Return of the King, and he's going to go through the Path of the Dead, and the soldiers are all like, oh, he's leaving us. This sucks.
He probably could have told them what he was doing.
Yeah, that might have been a smarter move.
A little lack of communication there.
Well, Aragorn needs some leadership classes.
Yeah.
Send him some John Maxwell books.
Exactly.
Seven Habits of Effective Leaders, or whatever it is. So... the soldiers are like, there's no hope, we can't win. And Théoden says, you're right. but we'll meet them in battle nonetheless.
Yeah.
Perfect example of this theme.
Well, once I realized they were saying hope a lot, and I was really listening for it, it came up nonstop, it felt like. Just people were talking about hope throughout all three movies.
Yeah. That's one of the cool things about watching them back to back to back, is that you see those themes a little more.
It was a really good experience to watch them all in a row.
Definitely.
I don't know if I'll do it again anytime soon.
No, probably not. But,
but it was awesome.
Yeah.
It just feels like one epic, because it's meant to be. It's meant to be one story, not three books.
Yeah.
It just felt like we were switching the disc because there wasn't enough room. Because even on Blu-ray, we had to split up each movie into two parts. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. So
is it because of all the special features? Why is it that?
Nope, it's just that they divided them into two parts to, I don't know, because that's what they did.
Wow.
Yeah, my in-depth analysis of their choice.
So, hey, you know, you were talking about rousing speeches.
Yeah,
and
a lot of those, too.
Well, one thing, you know, they did the stereotypical, what'd you do there?
I just tossed a cord and it hit my desk.
So there was a stereotypical speech right before a war given by Aragorn, and I thought to myself, you know what? This is stereotypical, but if I was actually at war, I think I would really need a speech like that. If you're just about to go into battle, a little pep talk would probably do me some good.
Sometimes we can be okay with a cliche.
Yeah, I think it really works.
I made there?
Yes. I'm not really, I don't feel like I've been bothered too often by these rousing speeches.
There's movies it works in, and there's movies where it doesn't.
Yeah.
And this is one where it works.
Yep.
There's certainly movies where it's like, okay, here we go with another speech, and this is so cliched, but it's pretty awesome here.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think, like, I think you hit the nail on the head where you said that hope's a major theme, but not in the way we'd expect, where it's like, yay, hope, we always have hope, and hope makes us happy. That's the way those themes tend to come out a lot,
mm-hmm.
but where it's a lot more mixed, and it's a lot more, yeah, we have hope, but things probably aren't going to go so well, and evil is a very real presence, mm-hmm. and it might win, and it stands a good chance of winning. What do you think from a Christian perspective about having things be nuanced that way?
I think from a Christian perspective, we have it's a mixed bag, because we know that, you know, from the Bible it says that we're going to suffer. So this world's not going to be all sunshine and roses and fun and everything's going to be good. So there is going to be some bad, but we do have the ultimate hope and the expectation that in the end we win, Jesus wins. So we have the ultimate hope that in the end it's going to be okay, but I don't think that there's any hope that our day-to-day is going to be okay.
Well, much the opposite. Like you said, there's a promise of suffering, and Jesus says in this world you'll have trouble.
But take hope.
Yeah.
Because I've overcome the world.
Yeah, that's right. So I think it's a really good portrayal and really accurate to what Scripture tells us to do, that there is hope, but it's not this easy, simple path where we just stick our heads in the sand and think everything's always going to turn out perfectly okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's one of the things I love about the series, actually.
So, you know, Gandalf, Frodo, Bilbo, and a bunch of elves all get to go to Valinor.
Yeah.
But what happens to, like, Ned when he dies? Or, you know.
And by Ned, you mean Boromir.
Boromir, right, from Game of Thrones. His name is Ned.
Or Barrowmore, as you called him at one point.
Yeah, sorry. So what happens to, where do they go?
I don't know. I'd have to research my mythology a bit.
Do you think, I wrote down a line here, and I want you to tell me if you think this is the reference to the Holy Spirit or just a reference to somebody's own conscience.
Okay.
So I think this is Frodo. Somebody's asking him to trust. I think it might have been Ned saying that you can trust me. And he says, I know what you would say, but it seems like, let me say this again. I know what you would say.
Oh, I know the line.
And it seems like wisdom, but for the warning in my heart.
Yeah, I think you could take that a couple different ways.
To me, instantly, I was thinking, we kind of have that. We get some warnings in our heart from God.
Yeah.
But I don't know if Frodo had the Holy Spirit active in his life.
Yeah, I would kind of be doubtful that that's how Tolkien would have intended it to be taken, mm-hmm. but I think you could apply it that way. Sure. So, which we've talked about before, that Tolkien liked applicability rather than allegory. So I don't think it would have meant to have been allegorical for the Holy Spirit, but he would have been perfectly fine with you saying, that reminds me of the Holy Spirit.
It reminds me.
Yeah, so well done.
Thank you.
One of the interesting things I find as I read about Lord of the Rings, especially in terms of postmodern criticism, and the fantasy genre has changed a lot over the last 15 or so years, mm-hmm. Is that there's increasing number of people who accuse Lord of the Rings of being very, very simplistic
in its
morality.
I don't think so at all.
Not simplistic in the sense that it's not a very complex world.
Yeah.
Because obviously it is. In terms of world building, very complex. But the accusations are things like you always know exactly who the good guys are. You always know exactly who the bad guys are. There are no gray characters. And on it goes. It's a very simplistic black and white morality.
I don't know if I would agree with that.
I don't agree with it one bit.
Why don't you talk about, well, let me give a brief, my first initial ideas. It sounds like you've really thought this through. So.
Well, yeah, because I've, you know, but this is stuff I've read about for several years.
Yeah, so here's some of my disagreements. I don't think that Ned's character is black and white.
Nope.
I don't think that Saruman is black and white.
Not one bit, and that certainly comes through if you read The Silmarillion, where he was a good guy.
Yeah, and Galarian, what was her name?
Galadriel.
Galadriel. You could see that there was temptation in her.
Definitely.
She
wanted very
to,
real.
Yeah, so she wanted to do the right thing, but there was a chance she could not do the right thing.
Yeah.
So I don't think I mean...
Even Sauron, if you go back in the history...
Frodo was the hero, and he was not necessarily all good in the end. You said Sauron? What?
If you go back in the Silmarillion... both Sauron and Morgoth were good in the beginning. They were created as good beings, and they fell. You know, it's very...
Wait, who created them?
Ilúvatar.
Oh, the main god.
Yeah. It's very Paradise Lost in the way Tolkien writes about it in the Silmarillion. So, but they were created as good beings. They were not created evil.
Oh, and so when Sauron created this ring... You told me that Sauron originally had a body, and then he didn't, and now he's just a spirit... And the ring kind of contains his spirit force.
Yeah.
Much like the Harry Potter story.
A little bit. It's his Horcrux.
Horcrux.
Yeah.
Right. And so the reason that he was dead is because the ring was destroyed. Is this correct?
Yes.
So at what point, you said he fell. When he fell, was he in human form? Or not human, but bodily form or spirit form?
No, he was spirit. But he would have been, at various times, was able to manifest in a bodily form, which you saw at the beginning.
With his finger cut off?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in terms of the end of the first age to the second age was the fall of Numenor, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that's correct. And Numenor fell because Sauron manifested in physical form and went there as an advisor. And he came as a friend, and he sweet-talked him and seemed really, really helpful to them at first.
A little worm-tongue action?
A little worm-tongue action, yeah. Which, by the way, never take counsel from a dude named Worm-tongue.
No, worst advisor name ever.
Yeah.
Grima Worm-tongue?
Yeah, like, I don't, you know, hey, President Obama, we got a new advisor for you. His last name's Worm-tongue.
And I think didn't they say he had a forked tongue like a snake?
Well, that was metaphorical.
But he made, like, a sound.
Well, yeah.
I think he might have had a snake tongue.
I don't think he actually did.
I never really saw it closely.
Yeah. We have Blu-rays. So we could probably find out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I lost my turn. Oh, so Sauron came to Numenor and through his advice basically caused the downfall of Numenor. So Sauron was able to come in physical form at various times, but he is primarily a spiritual being.
Good. So what would your main complaint be against these postmodernists that are saying that?
Well, and I like a lot of where the fantasy genre has come, because basically what we had after Tolkien was just clone after clone after clone of Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. Some of them very blatantly so. Basically, there's one guy in particular, his name's Dennis McKiernan, who wrote some books that he basically described them as being an homage to Tolkien, and the plot is almost completely identical.
Hey, well, let me stop you for a second. Let me just ask you a few stories.
Okay, but we have to get back because we didn't finish the point about
the
postmodernists.
Yeah, I know. Real quick, while we're on this, I just don't want to forget. My friend Kristen Larson, who has been on the Life Report, recommended to me Sword of...
Shannara.
Shannara. What would you say about that series?
Tolkien clone.
Completely?
I mean, if you want to read a Lord of the Rings written by a different author, go for it.
Okay.
But it's very, very similar in plot. The hero is a farm boy from a small, insignificant place in the world. A wise wizard-like character shows up and comes into his life.
Wait, you're kind of describing Star Wars.
A bit. He's chased by black rider-like creatures. There's a dark lord that he has to go up against. There's elves and dwarves. It's Lord of the Rings clone.
What are some ones you would recommend, then?
Oh, I don't know. There's not a ton of great fantasy series in terms of Lord of the Rings clones. I just don't care for that. If you're looking for good fantasy series, kind of before fantasy went in its shift. So with kind of non-postmodern fantasy, Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time series is 13 books long, so if you're up for that, it's great. Mm-hmm. If you're not...
You have the audiobooks that I could listen to, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Ursula K. Le Guin's Earthsea, which Dave wrote an article about on our website that was very good.
Yep.
So you can check out Dave's writing and then go read Earthsea. So, you know, obviously Narnia. You know, really great fantasy. It was kind of few and far between for a long time.
So that sword one that I was talking about, I actually bought the first book. Yeah. So now you kind of got me thinking.
Maybe you'd enjoy it. I loved it as a teenager, and I have autographed books of Terry Brooks because I went to a couple of those
Terry Brooks,
signings.
That's right. That's his name.
Yeah. They're not like the worst books ever. I don't want to make them sound horrible, but they're not very original.
Okay. So you good writer, not original in this particular series.
And that's how a lot of... That's basically what the fantasy genre was for a long time.
Okay, so now you can pick it up.
And George R. R. Martin basically changed that. Wow. He was one of the first guys to really kind of take all of the cliched ways of doing things and twist them and, you know, completely turn things around.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have elves or dwarves in his series. I mean, Tyrion's described as a dwarf, but he's not a dwarf in the way Gimli is, right? So he really... kind of turned the tide, and since Game of Thrones came out in 1996, fantasy has changed a ton.
Really?
And it's had a very postmodern influence on
it. So, name a few that you like besides Game of Thrones.
Joe Abercrombie's written some good books, and they're pretty funny, too, where he really takes very, very deliberately, far more so than Martin even, takes fantasy cliches and turns them on its head and twists them and does all sorts of horrible things with them, and it's hysterical. R. Scott Baker wrote a book, and I'm blanking on the name, the Prince of Nothing series. I don't remember. Okay. I think the first book is called The Darkness That Comes Before Us or something like that. And those were really good. I'll see if I can think of any more while we go on. But there's been some really good fantasy series, and so, far more original.
So I cut you off. You're about to unleash on postmodernism.
Well, you know, I think that... they have some valid complaints against the fantasy genre that it did become very simplistic in its morality, where you could tell instantly, this guy's a good guy, this guy's a bad guy, and there was no surprises whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But I don't agree in the case of Tolkien, and I don't think they're understanding the type of story he was trying to write.
Okay.
He was trying to write a mythology, he was trying to write something that was telling us deep truths about ourselves. Yes, there is a Dark Lord, and we never doubt for one second that Sauron is evil, and we never doubt for one second that Gandalf is good. You know, so... if you look at it just in those terms, you can accuse it of being simplistic, but when you really break it down and you start looking at the characters, Denethor, Boromir, Galadriel even, you mentioned, these are complex characters with complex moral motivations.
Very good.
We as an audience can always tell what is right and wrong in the series. And that's maybe the big difference between that and something like Game of Thrones, where we look at it and say, it's not always clear what's right and wrong. There's a lot more gray.
Yeah.
But in terms of the characters themselves and their own moral journey... there's quite a bit of gray in Lord of the Rings as well, even though we as an audience always know what's right and what's wrong.
I would agree.
Yeah.
Good job, Ben.
Thank you, sir.
Way to stick it to them.
Yeah. So I think that they're just not accepting that there's different ways of telling a story than theirs, which is a bit arrogant.
Yeah. Here's some other good thoughts we can get from Lord of the Rings. Frodo was saying to Gandalf that he was worried about, you know, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I even want to. And Gandalf was saying, well, that's how most people live. Actually, I think he said that's how old people feel that live to see such times. But it's what you do with that time that matters.
Yes.
Very nice.
Very important theme.
And then there was some sort of a kind of a turnaround for their view on men. Because at first I said men were viewed as not trustworthy, out for themselves, selfish, evil. But there was a line and it said, yes, there is weakness in men, but there is also courage and honor to be found in men.
Very true. Isn't that Boromir says that?
I don't know.
I think it is.
So maybe not as not as likely then to be an accurate source of information if it's coming from a man himself.
Well, but it kind of turns out true because Aragorn ushers in a golden age. But in terms of the way Tolkien viewed the history, that certainly didn't stick around for long. You know,
I have one final question before we move on to listener feedback. So if you have anything you want to say about Lord of the Rings, hit me with it now.
Nope, I'll hear your question, then we should definitely move on because it is getting late.
All right, Ben. There was a sweet fight scene with Gandalf in Return of the King where he had one hand a sword and one hand his staff, which was magical. And he was swinging it around, fighting. It was really cool. And the first thing I thought of was, who would win in a fight between Gandalf and Yoda?
Oh. Well, you have to account for the fact that a lightsaber could probably chop the staff in two.
Possibly.
However, Gandalf, we saw when he was battling the Balrog, is basically able to create a protective shield around himself.
Oh, well, and when that fire, when Saruman shot a huge fireball at him.
Yeah, same type of thing.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, Yoda's definitely going to be more mobile because he's smaller.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to have to give the edge to Gandalf.
Oh, man. I know. For some reason, I want to say Yoda. I think it's just because I love Yoda. And I think of him as one of these most powerful characters ever.
Yeah.
But as I really thought about this question...
Gandalf's super powerful.
I don't see Gandalf losing.
How would I put it like this? Maybe to see if we can satisfy everyone out there.
In a lightsaber?
If it's Yoda versus Gandalf the Grey, Yoda wins.
Yes. Yes.
But if it's Yoda versus Gandalf the White, Yoda's going down.
Yes. Ben, you couldn't have said it better. I think that's a great way to end this talk on Lord of the Rings. Listeners, if we miss anything that you just want to say about Lord of the Rings, you can email us at...
feedback@thescifichristian.com or call us at...
612-4121-SFC.
Yeah, and really, we could take any one of these themes and do an entire episode on it. Mm-hmm. So if you would be interested in hearing something like that, we'll certainly do more Lord of the Rings episodes in the future. This is by no means the last time we'll talk about this amazing
absolutely
series.
Not.
Matt,
yes.
You know our plans for a short episode?
How did we do?
We're at 1 hour and 57 minutes.
It's shorter than lately. Well, not really.
Not really. I vote that we keep it under 2 hours and hit that outro music.
Do it right now.
It has been a great day watching TV.
Never spent so much time with you in one period of time. Well, that might not be true.
What about our trip to Colorado?
Yeah.
Where we were in the car next to each other for
Our music thing is really messed up right now.
Okay, I'm shutting that. Talk for a second.
Uh-huh.
We're going to do this old school.
Oh, it's okay. Yeah, no, you're right. We've been together longer than that. But this was a long, good day. But I'm excited to go home and sleep. And then I guess I'll be seeing you tomorrow morning at church bright and early.
Yeah, so there it is. Not going to get interrupted this time.
All right, Ben.
We'll fix our sound card for next week. But Matt, it's been a great day, and I am out of gas.
That's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
I am Ben DiBono.
We're the Sci-Fi Christian. Signing out.
Now we're back, Ben. The first best episode.
It was great.
We'll try to do these throughout the year. And I right now, actually, in the middle of watching this series again. I'm on Two Towers, and you've just finished it, right?
Meaning in the middle of it, you watched Fellowship like a year ago.
No, I watched Fellowship probably about 3 or 4 months ago, to be fair. But I've got Two Towers on my shelf. I have an area of my bookshelf that's on deck, so it's on deck right now. And you just finished it in December, correct?
I did.
Just a few months back. So, all right, listeners, I'm going to hit the music. Thanks for joining us here for the best of the best. This is really for your sake, because at the end of the year, we're going to have you vote for your favorite...
The best ever.
The favorite winner of all the past winners. What's the best of the best? We'll find out here on the Sci-Fi Christian. But for now, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
It's like the Pro Bowl of Sci-Fi Christian episodes. I'm Ben DiBono.
And we're the Sci-Fi Christian, signing off.
August 5th, 2020. That's when you last watched it.
About August, really? Yeah. Wow, okay. How about you? You said December.
Yeah.
Okay.